Well, if I had known that there were that many ordained Presbyterian elders in this church, I'd be a lot more careful in what I say around here. That was quite a group, wasn't it? What is, of course, amazing about what you just participated in and what we participated in together is that we were saying that these men are the leaders of our church. And yet, what is the nature of the leadership that they have? What is the nature of the kind of character and attitude that an elder should have in Park City's Presbyterian Church? And what does it mean for all of us to consider carefully and thoughtfully what it means for us in our respective roles, whether it's leading a Bible study on Wednesday morning in among some of the women of our church, or if it's leading these ushers, or being an usher, or teaching our children, in all of the various and many capacities in which we would seek to follow the Lord and serve the Lord, both in the church and, if you heard me last week, outside of the church, in the work of the kingdom more broadly. What does it mean for us to be leaders? You know, the notion of leadership is, of course, one that has perhaps fallen on hard times. In an age of media hype, when the soundbite is king, it isn't so much the substance that matters, it's how you come across. And again, as I said last week in reference to President-elect Clinton, this time I'll mention a Republican, regardless of your politics, who can help but be deeply concerned when we read in a book like Selling the President, written by Joe McGinnis many years ago about the re-election campaign of Richard Nixon in 1972, where he said that those around the president seeking re-election knew very well that the reality of who he was as president didn't matter. What mattered was the perception that people had. I want to propose to you that that is extraordinarily dangerous. It's extraordinarily dangerous for our culture, and it's extraordinarily dangerous for our church when we find that our church begins to think or act like the world around us, despite all that we say to the contrary. Leadership in the Church of Jesus Christ means much more than perception. It has to do with reality. It probably comes as no surprise to any of us that I think most people are looking for a hero today. It seems that we're forever looking for a new person to believe in, a new politician who will fix things, a new star who we can admire, a new athlete who we can emulate, only to watch them quickly fade from view as they lose an election, or as their moral life takes a fall, or as they aren't as athletic as they used to be. And these personalities, if you analyze it, are really just projections of our own egos, the projection of our own ambition. We watch with envy and fascination at their intoxication of themselves, their abilities, their privileges, their love affairs, their zigzags. Surely People magazine is the national magazine of our culture, isn't it? Because we love to see these people in prominent positions. We love to read about their private lives. We love to somehow, what is it, imagine ourselves as them, or what if we were they, or with them where they were. And what we're really saying is a whole lot about the emptiness of our own lives. And we end up expecting more of them than they can ever deliver. I have a challenge for you this morning. You may think I'm utterly crazy. Pray for Madonna. If ever, and I don't say that with humor, pray for her. If ever there was a person who was on a suicide slope, it's Madonna. And those who watch our culture and know what the public adulation and cultural focus does to people say, this woman is on her way out. Pray for her soul before it's too late. Many years ago, the musical Jesus Christ Superstar did the same thing to Jesus Christ that we do to popular people today. It kind of made him into a folk hero. He was pursued by a series of followers and critics who wanted another hero, another projection of their own desire for greatness. And so they sought to make Jesus their hero until he disappointed them. That is, until, you see, he crossed some line and he wasn't a hero in the way they wanted a hero to be, and then they killed him. And just like Jesus Christ Superstar in the passage from the Gospel of Luke, which Ruth read to us, and by the way, this passage is a key pivotal passage in the Gospel of Luke. In our study of the Gospel of Luke, it's the turning point. It's the hinge of the Gospel, because from now on after this passage, Jesus sets his face like flint toward Jerusalem, and he goes toward the cross irrevocably after this passage. And just like Jesus Christ Superstar, this particular crowd was looking for someone who would be a hero. And so they wondered whether Jesus was that person. Some people thought he was John the Baptist come back to life. Some people thought he was one of the prophets of old who was maybe returned, a new incarnation of Elijah perhaps. And they were all excited about this. And each view of Jesus was inadequate, not so much because of what it said about him, but even more because of what it said about them. They were looking for a hero, for an exaggerated version of themselves. And so when Peter says it right and says, "You are the Christ of God," Jesus says, "Don't tell the crowd." Because the crowd will take even that bit of news and distort it into something which they would reinterpret in categories of their own greatness, as they did just after this when they sought to take Jesus and make him a king by force. We look for heroes, don't we? And we do so to feel better about ourselves. We're intoxicated with images of greatness in our culture. And in verse 25, Jesus talks about the prophet that comes to such a great hero. The man we're describing. The man who gains all the world. The great American hero who wants it all, who deserves it all, and somehow he gets it all. And some of you are thinking, boy, I'm glad this sermon isn't for me. I know I'm a Christian, and I know I'm different than that guy. I know I really don't want to be one of those heroes, and I know that I'm not really out for the whole world after all. Oh, really? Are Christians that different? Sometimes I wonder. Sometimes I especially wonder when seeing that 20 million or 40 million or 60 million born-again evangelical Christians in our society, and I sometimes wonder, what difference are they making? For many Christians, you see, the externals have simply not changed. We see ourselves in the same heroes as our non-Christian friends do. We seek our own ends, our own ambitions, our own desires, yes, with a little fringe of Christian frosting, a little veneer of Christian profession, to sweeten things up. But in the issues of real living, we look for all the world, like all the world, trying to gain all the world. You know, the Bible teaches, be in the world, but not of the world. You know that passage where Jesus says, and Paul says it actually, that we should be in the world, but not of the world. The crazy thing about the American church today, and I don't know if you're going to follow this. Sometimes when I've said this, people look at me with a blank stare. But think about this, if you will. The Bible says, be in the world, but not of the world. Christians today have just turned that on its edge. We, you see, are not in the world anymore. We've isolated ourselves out into our little Christian ghettos, into our holy huddles, into our little groups of Christians. Why, we even have Christian bowling leagues and Christian aerobics classes so we can listen to music that's Christian while we do our aerobics. We're not in the world. But we are profoundly of the world. That is to say, we have the same values as the world around us. We really don't stand apart in anything except distance. We distance ourselves from the world physically, but our values are the same as the world so often. We have brought the world into the church. Now, brothers and sisters, the things I've been saying to you in introduction to this sermon are so sober that I wouldn't blame you if you just wanted to get up and leave right now. If you've heard what I'm saying, these things are profoundly serious because they're talking about the nature not only of leadership, but the nature of our church and the nature of what it means to be God's people in this world. And I think we need to look at this passage as the hinge of the Gospel of Luke and make it the hinge of our souls. And we need specifically to look and see what it says about two things: the Son of Man and the sons of God, us. The Son of Man and the sons of God. First of all, the Son of Man. Onto the landscape of this world comes a huge contradiction: the Son of Man. The title which Jesus takes here and is used in this passage, and as you may know, is used more in the Gospels than any other title for Jesus. Jesus uses this way of describing himself more than any other name he gives himself. It comes from three places in the Old Testament, but perhaps the most important is from the book of Daniel, chapter 7, verse 13, where Jesus, as a boy, read this: "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, and was," and the Ancient of Days is God, the Lord himself, "and was led into his presence. He," the Son of Man, "was given authority, glory, sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Some people think the Son of Man title is a reference to Christ's humanity. It's not really. Primarily, it's a reference to just the opposite. In fact, his glorified deity, the fact that he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that he is the one who is above all, and that everything in heaven and earth is going to bow, as it were, before his kingship. But what happened? Enter Jesus, the peasant carpenter. In, as the Apostle Paul says, the form and appearance of a man. Jesus said that the Son of Man came into the world not to be served, but to serve. And then he defined service as giving his life as a ransom for many. Totally unexpectedly, Jesus reverses the expectation. He defers the service that the title Son of Man suggests he should receive. He doesn't receive it. Yet, instead, when he comes for the first time, he doesn't receive service, but he receives denial, suffering, scorning, spitting, and execution at the hands of the Romans. And then some people don't recognize him as anything but a failed folk hero, an imitation of the great from the past, another prophet who just couldn't hack it. And they can't understand something that is at the heart of the New Testament's teaching about Jesus Christ. God's kingdom is revealed in his humiliation. God's kingdom is revealed in his suffering. And God's kingdom is revealed in his death. This is why in verse 22 of what Ruth just read, it says that the Son of Man must suffer, be rejected and killed. Why is that word "must" there? The kingdom of God cannot be revealed by the methods of man's self-promotion. The kingdom of God must be revealed in the contradiction of Christ's apparent failure, a failure which accomplishes what no human program could do. What does the failure of Jesus Christ produce? Well, among other things, I'm looking at about 2,000 people that Jesus Christ has produced as renewed men and women, as hearts who have been quickened, as souls who have been made alive from the dead. And not just now, but for eternity. Brothers and sisters, no human program could do that. No accomplishment could make that happen, except the death of the King, the humiliation of the King, the suffering of the King. The failure of the King is our greatest success. And that's why Jesus says that Paul says that Jesus did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, not of his divine nature, but of all the prerogatives of being God's son. He emptied himself of all the perks, all the pleasures, all the neat things, all the hero worship, all the adulation, all the attention. He emptied himself of all of that and he became nothing. The Son of God made the world. It was his. He owned it. He governs it. And he gave it up. He gave up what we strive to get, the world. And the world, which idolizes the successful, rejected him outright. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world knew him not, the Apostle John says. And in his lifetime, the world scorned and ridiculed and humiliated him and rejected him. And in his death, men barely noticed him. But God noticed him. As Paul puts it in Philippians, in being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And then the very next verse by the Apostle Paul is this. Therefore, in other words, because of his failure, because he submitted to the awfulness of human failure for us, therefore God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, that name at which every knee should bow of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth. And yes, Daniel 7 will come to pass. The Son of Man will be given a dominion and an everlasting kingdom. And that's what it means in verse 26, where it says that the Son of Man will come in his glory and in the glory of his Father and in the glory of the holy angels who will come with him. That will happen. There will be a day. Do you believe that? Do you believe that there will be a day when somehow every human eye, every human ear will see and hear the Lord Jesus as he returns, but this time the return will be quite different than the first coming. It will not be as a peasant carpenter. It will not be in humiliation. It will not be to die. It will be to reign. And we will know it without any doubt. And so will those who now scorn him. Forsaken, ridiculed, nailed, spat upon, killed, totally alone. There were no angels on that garbage dump outside of Jerusalem. But when one man, the true man, the man, the second Adam, defies all the self-glorying norm of the world, and he gives up his glory rather than clinging for all his life to it, then the angels hold their breath at the wonder of it. And they ready their wings for a triumphant return. And all the haughty world will see the Father say to the Son, come, come and take this kingdom that has been prepared for you. You see, the life of Jesus Christ is played out on a timeline. First suffering, first humiliation, then glory, then the kingdom. And that's the point that gets applied to us as we move from talking about the Son of Man to the sons of God. The point is that our lives are also lived out on a timeline. Now is life in its hardest. Now is life lived in the shadow of the cross. Beneath the cross, as we sang a few moments ago. Now is life not all that we would like it to be. Dear brothers and sisters, stop trying to fix your lives. Stop trying to get all the suffering out of your life. Stop trying to get all the hardship out of your life. It's normal in a fallen world. It's normal that we don't experience a blissful life of happiness and joy unrestrained. Now, Jesus teaches us, is the time when we, like our Master, are to learn to deny ourselves, take up our crosses daily and follow him. Now, I want to propose to you, dear friends, that Christians often make three very important misses, wrong guesses, when we think about what it means to deny ourselves and take up our crosses. May I quickly suggest those to you before I point you in what I think is the biblical direction of what that phrase means? First of all, it is not accurate to think that taking up my cross, denying myself, means I bleach out my personality, that I water down my distinctiveness because, quote, Jesus is all that matters, close quote. Self-denial is never to be confused with what you could call Eastern mystical renunciation. I am nothing, Jesus is everything. That is not a biblical way to speak. Christian sanctification makes no virtue out of being bland or even obscure. Self-denial doesn't mean being drab for Jesus. Sometimes Christians even misinterpret the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, meekness, self-control. We misinterpret those fruit of the Spirit to mean somehow blending in, not being very noticeable, just kind of being nice little window dressing in the scenes of life. But no, those are strong, and if I could use the term, muscular fruit. They are to characterize people in a very definite way. They don't make us stand out less, they make us stand out more. The second error in understanding what self-denial and cross-bearing is means that we purposely pursue suffering. A kind of asceticism where we deny ourselves any pleasures whatsoever. Whatever it is we like to do, we say, well, I can't do that. Suffering is not in and of itself redemptive. Do you know that? And here we have a holdover from a mystical and even medieval way of thinking where Christians today believe that we need to sort of contribute to what Jesus did on the cross. Yes, I know he died on the cross, but I need to add a little bit to it. And I need to prove to God that I'm worthy of what he did for me on the cross. So I'll suffer a little bit and show him I'm worthy. Brothers and sisters, you do not add a thing to the cross. We do not add a thing to the cross by our own suffering. You could wear a hair shirt all day, every day, and it wouldn't mean a thing to God. It doesn't. Don't seek suffering. Believe me, it will come if you're following Christ. Right? In and of itself, suffering isn't even good for you. It's not to be sought. And we mustn't fail to understand the completeness of Christ's work. He accomplished it all. We add nothing to what he did on the cross. Third misunderstanding about self-denial and cross-bearing is closely related to the second. It is often to see the hurts and the wounds and the misfortunes of this life as crosses that we bear. To be born valiantly, to have an ill-tempered boss, an alcoholic parent or spouse, a roommate who makes life miserable, 3 children under 5 years old, or even an incurable illness. All of these things might be serious and might be grievous, and they might call for strong spiritual medicine, but I don't think we do right when we dignify them or try and dignify them by calling them crosses. It is simply not what Jesus was referring to here. So I hope you're ready to find out what he was referring to here when he tells us to take up our cross and follow him. It means these things, very simply. It is a conscious, deliberate forfeiting of my rights in small and large ways. It is an experience which imitates Jesus Christ. It is a following after Jesus in this sense. Jesus gave up his prerogatives and his rights, and he yielded his rights to his own glory. And so am I to give up my prerogatives and yield my rights to my own glory. There is a difference, of course. Jesus gave up what he already had. We give up what we wrongly seek as our own. Self-denial is the lifelong, ongoing renunciation of wanting to be a hero, of wanting to be glorified in the eyes of men. Second, self-denial and cross-bearing means inevitable conflict with the values of this world. In Romans chapter 12, the Apostle Paul says, "Do not be conformed to this world." The word "world" there is the word eon. Eon really means the way in which the world's spirit is expressing itself in this age. How is the world's spirit expressing itself in this age? In People magazine, to put it simply. So we renounce that kind of self-emulation. We renounce trying to be powerful. We renounce trying to be in the center of things. We renounce the glory that we seek to give ourselves and that we seek to get from others. And I do not allow the world to mold me into its values and its views. And if I do that, I may experience in my self-denial what Jesus experienced when he was publicly displayed in his humiliation. I too may be held up for public ridicule because, you see, when I renounce the world's values, that world may break me. The world does not like people to renounce its values. And it may say to you and to me, "Oh, is that the way you want to treat us, the world?" We'll break you for that. The world hated Christ. We are his followers. Are we to expect less? And in repudiating the self-glorying values of the world may mean that the world becomes infuriated with me, just as it became infuriated with Jesus Christ when in a fit of rage it went out and hung him on a tree outside of Jerusalem. And finally, self-denial and bearing my cross is the only way to real joy. It's saying yes to Christ and his kingdom. It's saying, "Yes, I'm on the winning team," even when it appears that you're losing. It's an affirmation that history is going somewhere, an affirmation that we live between the times, between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. It's an affirmation in our belief in the future of what God has said he's going to do when he returns in the glory of his angels, and when he comes, he will make all the wrongs right. He will wipe away all the tears. He will take away all the suffering. And I am a part of that platform. I am a part of that program. And thank you very much. I'll take that one better than any man-made one that can ever be produced. Because that's the one that's going to win. That's the kingdom that's going to come through. That's the answer to the whole human predicament. And that's the team I want to be on. And therefore, self-denial isn't a moribund, unhappy existence. No, Jesus, for the joy set before him, the author of Hebrews says, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. It is a ringing affirmation there is something far more wonderful to live for, a reason far bigger and far better than anything the world offers, more wonderful than my glory, more wonderful than my pleasure, more wonderful than my own self-interest. There's something better, brothers and sisters, and it's being a part of his team. It's being a part of his kingdom. May I say something to the young people in the room? The world is molding you guys unbelievably. I read a couple of months ago an edition of your school newspaper, the Highland Park High School newspaper. I don't know if I could have stood up under some of the pressures that you stand up under in that school to be people who stand for Christ. But I simply want to tell you, congratulations. You're on the winning team. You're on the right side. And even if it means at times that you say no. I heard a story the other day about a fellow, a little guy who's in the seventh grade in a school in our community, in our area. And he believed that a teacher had caved in to a bad value that was being expressed by one of the kids and just ignored it and winked at it. And he went to the teacher and he said, very humbly, I don't think you set a good example. And the teacher said, you're right. Thank you. I'm going to do better. Young people, I don't know how you do it, except that you need one another and as brothers and sisters in the Lord. You need the encouragement of Tim and Tinsley and the people in our church that are going to help you stand for Christ. To sum up what self-denial and cross-bearing means is that our lives are lived out on a timeline too. If we pursue our own glory and our own kingdom now, then the promise is that we will lose those things upon Christ's return. Is that not what verse 25 says? What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he returns with his glory and the glory of the Father and the glory of the holy angels. Seek your glory now, men and women. And when the king returns, that's what you'll have. Your glory. Seek his glory now, men and women. And when the king returns, that's what you'll have. His glory. And if we lose our lives now for the sake of Christ and his interests and his kingdom, then at his return we will find our lives and our kingdoms given back to us in ways that we cannot even imagine. And according to verse 26, we will participate in the glory of the Son of Man, the glory of his kingdom, whatever that means, whatever your imagination tells you it means, we will participate in it. And that's what the Apostle Paul means in Romans 8 when he says, if we suffer with Christ now in order that we might be glorified with him then. I have been a Christian, men and women, for 29 years this coming summer. I had an interesting thought the other day. In perhaps 29 more years, it'll all be over for me. We're athletes on a field, you know. Soon we'll be in the stands watching others play. I don't want to regret that I didn't play harder or smarter, or that I got on the wrong team. I don't ask you this morning to screw up your courage and make sacrifices for Christ. No, I ask you to renounce all that you have to obtain a life that is much more satisfying. I ask you to count all things as rubbish for the surpassing value of knowing Christ and serving him. I ask you to take off your store-bought rags and put on the regal robes of an ambassador of Christ. I ask you to remember that you give up nothing in light of all you gain. On January 8, 1956, Aka Indians in Peru killed Jim Elliot and four missionary friends with him as they were trying to bring the gospel to the remote Aka tribe of 60 people. Four young wives lost husbands, nine children lost fathers. And later Elizabeth Elliot wrote, in the context of a world that was saying, as that thing hit the headlines across the country, calling it a nightmare of a tragedy, she said, no. She said, the world does not recognize the truth of Jim Elliot, her husband's credo that he lived by. And it was this, hear it please. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. There is a sad but certain reversal that is going to take place. Those who seek their own glory and their own kingdom now and pursue it, according to verse 26, they are the ones who are going to be ashamed of Jesus when he returns. It's a little awkward, this business about talking about Christ and following him. It's a little bit too much, Skip. I mean, tone it down a little, would you? brothers, sisters, don't be ashamed of the words of Jesus. The promise is that if we are, oh, Jesus will be ashamed of us when the angels descend with his glory. For Jesus Christ, it was denial, rejection, the cross. For his followers, it may be denial, rejection, and the cross. For Jesus Christ, suffering is followed by joy and glory beyond our imagining. And for us, suffering is followed by joy and glory beyond our imagining. Listen, finally, if you will, to the words of the Apostle Peter. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exaltation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. If it's hard now, you're on the right team. If it's difficult now, you have the right captain. If it hurts you now, you're in the right place. Stay with your king. Don't seek another. Because the promise of the word of God is that he's going to return full of glory and the glory of all the holy angels. And they might even begin their descent before this service is over. At least, I promise you this, it will be sooner than you think.